David Seaborg. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
All right, we're glad to have you.
Welcome to Let 'Em Talk. Well, maybe give us a little background for the New York audience. Your dad is an important guy. Tell us what the Manhattan Project is for all those kids out there who've never heard of it.
Well, the Manhattan Project was a project to develop the atomic bomb to stop Hitler and the Japanese in World War II to end the war and, keep Hitler from taking over the world, basically. And it was something that most people who, well, I don't know if I can say most, but many people on it after the project wanted to go on and keep developing nuclear weapons and racing with the Russians. And other scientists on it, like my dad and Oppenheimer, felt that enough was enough, that once we had stopped Hitler, that was the purpose of the whole thing, and there was no reason to go on, and that nuclear weapons should be controlled because they're dangerous things, and they take a lot of money out of social programs and peaceful programs and possibilities of saving the environment. So, Edward Teller was one of the people who wanted to continue things, and my dad was on the side of arms control.
Well, how did that affect his career, looking at what happened to Robert Oppenheimer, who basically wound up losing his career in a battle with Edward Teller and being accused sub rosa anyway of being a rosa, a pink?
Right.
How did your dad survive that era?
Well, it's funny. He didn't get in any real trouble on that. I'm not quite sure. My dad was always a liberal, but he was never a leftist. You know, he was not extreme enough, I guess, to have that kind of problem. I'm not really sure of the history of that, why it wasn't... I guess Oppenheimer was looked upon as a security risk because his views were too far on the left direction for some people, and he got into trouble, I think, very unjustly. I think that, people should have the right to take on any view that they want. There should be freedom of speech. I think it was very unfair. My dad was himself, he served as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Nixon, Kennedy, then Johnson, and then for a short while Nixon. And he did have to do some battle with the conservative forces during the, for example, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. He had to do quite a bit to convince Congress to ratify that and get that through. But he was never labeled as... a security risk or have any real career troubles as a result of that.
David, was this a debate that you heard in your home? Were these issues discussed over dinner? Or?
Yeah, it was very interesting being raised by Glenn Seaborg because he told me how it was hard to get, if it weren't for him, we wouldn't have had a nuclear test ban treaty, and the politics of getting that through Congress and some of the different things that happened. It was very interesting, and I think that usually we agreed on a lot of issues. We agreed on the need to control nuclear weapons bilaterally, but we had discussions, for example, on nuclear power, where my dad and I did not agree. He was very much an environmentalist, actually, and he did quite a lot for speaking out for recycling and saving open space, and he considered part of being an environmentalist being for nuclear power, and he always thought that environmentalists were going to come around to his position, but of course
disagree.
I felt that nuclear power would always have serious environmental problems, such as storage of waste and potential of nuclear proliferation, and the tailings from the mining.
What about accidents?
Accidents, which he thought were preventable by, he thought that was a worry, but he thought that it was preventable by being very careful and keeping on top of things. The other thing was he thought that solar energy was something that was very difficult to develop and would take a very, very long time, and I thought that solar energy could be developed if it were given a better chance. That the reason it was lagging so far behind had a lot to do with it didn't get the kind of subsidies that that I would have liked to have seen. And after all, we subsidize nuclear power, we subsidize fossil fuels. So why not subsidize solar and level the playing field, as well as other alternative energy?
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that led you to develop in a different direction, to become an evolutionary biologist, to become an environmentalist. What in your life were some of the changing points, or some of the points that led you to move in that direction?
Well, first, becoming a scientist had a lot to do with being just raised in a small town in the San Francisco Bay Area called Lafayette, where there were lots of snakes and lizards out in the hills, and I used to go out and just catch frogs, snakes, and lizards and keep them.
What's your mom like?
Pardon me, my mom?
Yeah.
Very tolerant.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
to bring home snakes and lizards.
Very supportive and tolerant of that interest of mine.
That's lucky.
Which was very helpful. And I think that interest, a lot of young boys do that, and I never outgrew that. In fact, it grew. A lot of young boys who do that, they then lose that interest as they get older. And with me, that interest in animals and snakes and the natural world and animals that most people don't love just grew and grew in me. And I got more and more interested in evolutionary theory as I took courses in college. And then, as far as the environmentalism, partly that was my upbringing from my parents, raised in that kind of thinking, but it was partly seeing that the natural world was disappearing. There was less and less to study for my science,
right,
and
the
fact that there was really a problem.
And you got involved with the rainforest, saving the rainforest in particular.
Yes, because in the early 70s, when the rainforest was not a big issue, and I was a grad student, we had luncheons with the grad students and the professors, and we'd take some. In these seminars, there were professors who presented these ideas of roads were being built for the first time, large roads through the rainforest that would open the rainforest up to being burned and cut and destroyed. And so that was why I was able to know about the problem before environmental activists got involved in it, because I was listening to scientists talk about it over lunch, and I had access to the science of it before activists did. And so I was really one of the first people to get involved and to convince other environmentalists that the rainforest is a really important issue. And I think the reason the rainforest is such an important issue is that half of the world's species live in the rainforest. It's just incredibly biologically diverse. And the rainforest used to cover 14% of the planet, the tropical rainforest, and now it's only 7%. Half of it has been destroyed. It's being destroyed at the rate of about 100 acres per minute, which is equal to about half the size of the state of California every year.
Wow.
Approximately the size of the state of New York every year, roughly, worldwide, of rainforest is destroyed, either through cutting or burning. And of course, this not only destroys the biological diversity of the planet and contributes to a great extinction crisis, it also is very serious because it contributes to global warming, because normally trees, when left intact, they take carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas, out of the atmosphere and put it in to their own growth, and then breathe out oxygen through the process of photosynthesis.
Yeah.
So the carbon dioxide, which is heating the planet and which is being produced by our industrial activity, which is not the only greenhouse gas but is the main greenhouse gas, is instead of being taken up by the trees once they're cut or burned, is actually released into the atmosphere by the trees, because after they're cut, they decompose and release the carbon dioxide, or if the forest is burned, which it often is, to make barren land to grow food crops or to have grass grow to raise cattle, when the forest is burned, this burning releases carbon dioxide. So it turns the trees from allies into things that exacerbate the problem. Also, the burning of the forest affects the local climate and local rainfall patterns, so farmers in the tropical areas are no longer able to grow food.
Well, why should, you know, people in the cities of the north, in areas that they don't have many rainforest within them, like in the United States, why should they be concerned with what's happening in Brazil or Central Africa or in Southeast Asia?
Well, I did mention, of course, the fact that the global climate, the greenhouse effect, is exacerbated. So that's one reason we should be concerned about that, is because this affects our climate up here as well. It's a global thing, global warming, the greenhouse effect. In fact, the number of El Niños has increased and their intensity has increased. And that turns out now there's scientific evidence that that is due to global warming. Another thing that is that global warming causes is an increase in hurricane and tornado activity. In fact, California used to have 3 tornadoes per year. Now it has 30 per year. That's largely due to the increased heat and increased energy of the on the planet due to the global warming, the greenhouse effect. So all this is greatly exacerbated by the rainforest. The fact that we're losing species at a rate greater than any time in the history of the Earth. There have been 5 major mass extinctions on the Earth, and the last one was 65 million years ago, the one that killed the dinosaurs. This mass extinction that humans are causing is the biggest in the 6th extinction, and it's the biggest in the history of the planet if the rate keeps up. It will be, that is to say. Well, this loss of species is serious because many of these species are very, very valuable in industry and in medicine. In fact, as you go through the day, every hour of the day you are using products from the rainforest, and many of the drugs and chemicals from the rainforest have great pharmaceutical value. They cure fungal disease. They cure cancer and tumors. They're antiviral. They do many, many things for the health. Most modern medicines are actually derived from plants or other things from the natural world. The rosy periwinkle, which is a plant that grows in the Madagascar rainforest, has been shown to cure childhood leukemia. And with the chemicals from the rosy periwinkle, they've turned the death rate from childhood leukemia from 80% down to 20%. Also, the rainforest controls the climate of the Earth in another way. It's something called the albedo, or reflectivity of the rainforest, which is because it's a green belt, the amount of sunlight that's reflected around the tropics of this green belt of rainforest is a certain amount, and then when it's cut and becomes brown, there's a different amount of reflectivity of the sun's light. And this actually has a really profound effect on global climate. So this affects our ability to produce food up here because it changes the climate. So this whole climate issue is really, really important because it's going to affect the, or it already is, but it's going to more in the future if something isn't done, affect very profoundly the ability of people to produce food in areas like the United States.
Well, that's very interesting. So actually the activity, the industrial activity, the cutting down of rainforests, the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is in fact measurably causing change, that you believe that human activity in the last 100 or so years is actually changing the environment and the climate.
Yes. In fact, interestingly enough, it's gotten to the point where the Antarctic ice sheets, the ice around Antarctica, well, Antarctica, of course, is all basically covered with ice, but the outer part, the icebergs, are breaking up. So Antarctica, actually the western Antarctic ice sheet, is starting to break up, and it turns out that it's geologically unstable, that the whole western Antarctic ice sheet has in the past disintegrated, and that has been due to climatic shifts. And it turns out that this can break up and cause very, very rapid climatic shifts that are very strong, very tremendous in their effect, and happen within just a period of decades.
Well, what can people do about this? What is the main cause of the destruction of the rainforest? Is this an economic pressure on people?
Yeah, it's a number of things. One is overpopulation, just plain too many people and too many hungry mouths to be fed. So controlling world population would be very helpful. But another is the unequal and unfair distribution of wealth, where you have a few very rich people and many, many very poor people. And governments, instead of doing land reform or redistribution of the wealth, they simply open up the rainforest to move people into it, to have them cut the forest to farm it, to try to solve the problem that way. The government would rather do that than face something like land reform and stand up to the rich and the powerful who control the governments anyway. Then when the rainforest is cut, unfortunately, it only lasts, you can only farm it for about 5 years because tropical soil is a lot poorer than temperate soil. Most of the nutrients in the rainforest are in the trees. So after about 5 years, these people have to move on, cut more rainforest, and farm again. Another problem is this issue of globalization, NAFTA and GATT, which are, free trade, which are putting a lot of pressure on countries to have to meet their foreign debt and therefore produce goods such as coffee and cashew nuts and other crops that are grown by cutting rainforest. And another set of pressures is from the cattle ranchers who cut the rainforest to let grass grow and grow cattle.
Another
Or is McDonald's still an important, and Burger King and the rest of these companies still important?
Actually, Burger King has quit due to the boycott initiated by the Rainforest Action Network, which is headquartered in San Francisco and which works closely with my World Rainforest Fund. So they, through consumer pressure, have stopped their destruction of the rainforest to a large extent because they were hit in the pocketbook through the boycott. Another pressure, by the way, is simply cutting the wood for timber. So cutting down on the amount of use of rainforest wood as consumers here is very helpful. I was instrumental in getting the Berkeley City Council to pass a resolution, actually a legally binding law, to not use any more rainforest wood or redwood in any of their contracts that they hire businesses for to build things.
Well, it was discovered here in New York that the boardwalk and the wood that was used for park benches were coming from rainforest areas, for example.
Oh, how interesting.
Time. Yeah, and there was protests against that.
Did that have any effect?
I'm not 100% sure how that turned out, and maybe actually some of our callers would know more. Yeah, 212-209-2900.
That is an interesting issue.
How that turned out, because I know they wanted to rebuild a number of boardwalk areas with forested rainforest wood, and that there was some protest against the City Parks Department for that. So I don't know how that turned out.
Anybody that participated in that, call in and tell us what was going on.
I know we have a lot of environmentalists out there. Listen to Let Them Talk.
We should take some calls.
Yeah, our guest is David Seaborg, and his father, Glenn Seaborg, was one of the developers of plutonium and an advocate of nuclear power, and his son is now an advocate of saving the rainforest. So it's interesting.
When you say was, my dad just recently died.
Yeah. That's right, a couple months ago. Huh?
Yeah, so he left quite a legacy of really working for peace to end the arms race and to try to get nuclear weapons controlled and cut back on the number of them and to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and he
was an early advocate of the Test Ban Treaty.
Yes, in fact,
one of the architects of it.
He was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy when the Limited Test Ban Treaty was put through, which meant no more tests. Limited Test Ban Treaty means the treaty was limited in that you could no longer do nuclear testing in the atmosphere, but they say limited because the treaty was limited to the atmosphere. That is, you could still test
underground. Right.
Well, was healthy and lived to a ripe old age. How did he survive developing plutonium?
Well, let me explain that in a minute. I just wanted to add that
he worked for
a comprehensive test ban treaty after that. And finally, under Clinton, we do have a comprehensive test ban treaty, so there is no more testing allowed even underground. And I just wanted to say, I think of all his accomplishments, the discovery of plutonium and his theory that redesigned the whole periodic chart, which was a huge scientific breakthrough, his saving of open space, his advocacy of recycling, of all his accomplishments, the biggest one was getting the original Test Ban Treaty, in my opinion.
And he won a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, he did get the Nobel Prize for chemistry in 1951 for his discovery of plutonium.
At a fairly young age.
Yeah, he was one of the youngest ever.
Yeah, that's right. And the other reason he got it was he did have this theory that redesigned the periodic table, which was a big breakthrough for chemistry.
But doesn't he have an element named after him?
Yeah, he does. Seaborgium.
Seaborgium.
Element 106. So that's a big, big honor. He considers that a bigger honor than the Nobel Prize, because people will remember that, you know, that'll be on the periodic table
for high
school students to see decades from now.
Right.
But anyway, the reason I think that his biggest accomplishment was the nuclear test ban treaty was, is because that took the testing of nuclear weapons out of the atmosphere, which put things like strontium-90 and other radioactive elements into the atmosphere and kept us from having to breathe them. Now, how did he survive the discovery of all this research on chemical elements like plutonium, you know, radioactive elements, and not get cancer or have his health affected by that?
Yeah, how did
he
work with
those? He knew of the dangers. My father was very much an advocate of being very careful from the beginning about radioactivity. So he did have colleagues who were less careful in their lab work or who were unlucky and got exposed and did die of cancer. And he was very careful. He knew of these dangers. And
he didn't take it lightly.
He wasn't as naive as Marie Curie, for example, working with radium in big vats.
Yeah, that's right. Because
getting it all over
by this time, people who were far-sighted at least did know. Some people did not know, but some people did know, even in the 40s, that there was a potential danger. And when my dad advocated nuclear power, he was very much to be in favor of being very safe and very careful with it. So I remember once when he was, we were riding in a car, and I was just a little kid, and there was a friend of the family's who I wanted to sit near, and I was on the floor of the car near her, and my dad did not want me there because he had been working in the lab and walking on the lab floor and didn't want me near his shoes, which could have low levels of radiation on them. Mm.
So he was a believer that any amount of radiation was bad for you.
Well, he thought that if I was too close to the shoes at a short distance, it could have been potentially dangerous. Whether he thought, I mean, what your last question there refers to is the debate where between people like John Goffman, who was his grad student, and who actually got along very well with my dad, and who was one of the well-known critics of nuclear power, and a very nice guy, by the way, who says that there is no threshold below which nuclear energy or you know, radiation is dangerous, that there's no threshold, that at any level it can be dangerous, although, of course, less dangerous at lower levels than at high levels, that it's just a continuous graph. If you chart health effects versus radiation, whereas other people say there's a threshold below which, if the levels are low enough, they won't hurt you. And I don't really know, to be honest, what my dad's position was on that. I'd have to, if
we'll
I can remember a statement
that
on that, I'll let you know.
Thank you. We'll have to keep watching that one, because there's a lot of low-level sources, whether it's your smoke detector on the wall or
your
many other things.
Your glow-in-the-dark clock.
Yeah,
smoke
a lot of
detectors
things.
Use americium, which is one of the elements my dad invented.
Really, and that's interesting. Well, it's in every smoke detector, and sometimes I hear people protesting that, so
yeah.
We'll talk about it. We'll open up the phones, 209-2900.
What's up?
Now, David Seaborg, among all these other achievements and interests, you are also a poet and a writer of poetry. And I was wondering if, as we wait for the calls to come, and they are coming, if you could give us a sample of some of your poetry.
Okay, well, here's a short one, and it's called Siddhartha Gautama, which is actually the name of the person who became the Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama went out in the dark. He lost himself found with now here to park. He left his whole head on the table back ohm and sat on a spot where his eyes couldn't roam. When he was the tree grow, asked, where did the ego? But if all is the void, it's best that I know no. Gautama Siddhartha went out in the dark, thought life a wise owl, but found it's a lark. Was small as an elephant, big as an elf, went looking for God, found only himself.
Wonderful, David Seaborg.
All right.
We're going to go to the phones now. Thank you very much. 209-2900, area code 212, and you're on the radio.
Hello.
Hi there. Thank you, David Seaborg, and thank you for the program we're putting on tonight. Thank God for San Francisco and that area, because we seem to have people who are looking further than most. I agree with everything that has been said, and more. I wish that people could see that if we don't deal with some of the issues that are spoken about, that there's not going to be an atmosphere, there'll be a lot of disease, we won't have food that's edible. But I have a question about nuclear power that I've been trying to get answered for a couple of years now, and I can't get an answer. And that's about nuclear fusion reactors, which haven't been discussed for about, I don't know, almost 30 years now. I wanted to know if, as I recall, nuclear fusion reactors were considered a safe reactor and that the only problem was there was a small amount of waste that could be shut up into space, actually become space junk, and basically there would be energy for the whole world. And the reason why they sort of shoved it under the rug was that, first of all, the reactors at the time were huge because, like the first, computer was huge. It was in the beginning stages of its development, and the oil people didn't want, the oil industries didn't want to give up their money. I mean, it was the same as how it is today. Everyone was still greedy and wanted to keep, the money where it was and use it for power and dealing with, different political issues. And,
so, I would say the first problem with nuclear fusion, mm-hmm. by the way, I should explain, the regular nuclear reactor works by nuclear fission, which is the energy that you get from splitting the atom. It produces tremendous amounts of energy simply because you lose a little bit of mass, and that's converted to energy, and just a little bit of mass of the atom equals lots and lots of energy by Einstein's equation E equals mc squared. That's exactly what Einstein's equation means, is that the speed of light is a big, big number, and when you square it, it's even much bigger. So E equals mc squared means a little bit of mass equals lots and lots of energy. So that's how, in a nutshell, the regular fission reactor works, is by splitting the atom. Now, the fusion reactor works by taking small atoms like hydrogen and fusing them together. And again, you lose a little bit of mass and produce even more energy. Well, the problem is, and of course also I should add, the atomic bomb is a fission bomb. It just releases the energy much more faster than a fission reactor. And the hydrogen bomb is a fusion bomb, which releases much, much more energy and makes a much bigger explosion. Again, just doing it a lot faster than a fusion reactor would. The problem with a fusion reactor, first, is it's really, really technically hard to do. And my dad and I often discuss this, and he always made the point to me that it's something very far off in the future. And he was right. It's not some political thing there. It really is technically incredibly hard to do. He even said it might be so hard that nobody something that humans can never do, although I don't think he really believed that. I think he was just emphasizing his point.
Besides, the largest fusion reactor in the world is 93 million miles out in space.
That's the other point I was going to get to, and that is a very good point, and that's the sun, 93 million miles away, is a huge fusion reactor. And so if we harness the sun's energy, we're using a fusion reactor that's 93 million miles away, which is exactly where fusion reactors should be. It is much easier to, of course, photovoltaics and some kinds of solar energy that are active and not passive are not economical yet or are hard to do, but some forms of solar energy are already being harnessed, and lots of progress is being made even on photovoltaics, and I said earlier tonight that we can do a lot more if we just put in the money and give it a chance. The main reason that it's been cut back started with our Governor Reagan of California. First, he killed the program in my state, and then later his president killed what President Carter started up.
Now, Ronald Reagan didn't like your dad too much because didn't he try as president to have all your dad's papers classified?
Well, that is interesting. You researched that.
I did. There's a number of web pages about your dad out there. Believe me, they have a lot of information.
Plus, we love the whole issue of classified information.
I'll return to that in a minute. I just want to finish the caller's question just to point out that there may be serious environmental problems with fusion that we don't know about. Let me just point out that they thought that nuclear energy, fission energy, would be too cheap to monitor and free of any kind of environmental concerns, and look what we ended up with. So I think that there can be, when you talk about the amount of either laser energy you need to produce or the high temperatures you need to produce and the possible tritium that could be produced, there could be large environmental problems, although I am not expert on that, so I can't, and I don't think anyone's really expert because it hasn't really been developed and tried yet. We might not know until it is developed. Now,
what about cold fusion?
Cold fusion was developed by these guys in Utah, who Pons and Fleischman are their name, and they thought that, you know, this would be something you can do at low temperatures. And so George Bush called up my dad and flew him out to get his advice on cold fusion, because it was developed during the Bush administration. So my dad went to advise Bush on cold fusion, and he told him that it is very cold. In other words, it doesn't work. And he said, you know, I'll go ahead and develop a committee to study it so you can legitimately say it doesn't work. That's the politically way, you know, feasible way to do it, but it isn't going to work scientifically. And my dad was proven right. Cold fusion just didn't work. Now, as far as Reagan and my dad keeps these really, really thorough diaries he used to keep, even since he was a kid. And he put these together into a journal. I mean, I don't know how he got so much done and yet had the time to write up these diaries, which were then he had put into journals, which he has like, must be 20 or 30 volumes of, you know, all the things on his life are journalized and in print now. And he, you know, it's all the people he met when he went to China and met Zhou Enlai and went to the Soviet Union and talked to Khrushchev, all about his travels, his research, the people he met. These real detailed journal. I'm in that, in the journal in many areas when I hiked with him, or, you know, Dave and I went on a hike today, and so on. So he has these detailed journals, and he uses them to write. He's written several books on his work under presidents, and his work as chancellor of the University of California and as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, you know, historical stuff. And people also use his journal for history of science and of political things and so on. Well, when Reagan was in power and my dad was back as a professor at the university and no longer with the government, these people from the Reagan administration went in to my dad's house and insisted on going through all the journals and deleting parts of the journals out permanently and taking them away from my dad. He had a hard time getting the journals even back. It took him a long time ever to recover the journals. And when he got them back, many of the pages and many of the passages were deleted, because the Reagan administration claimed these were big security risks and should be top secret, even though they had been public knowledge up until, you know, they did this and nobody made any fuss or to do about it. And, of course, my father would never write anything that's really would compromise national security in his journal. So this was a very egregious affront on his civil rights, but I think this is very typical of the Reagan administration, to be very frank.
He suggested that there was certain things he had written about various people he'd worked with, including people like Richard Nixon and other people, Edward Teller, that were critical and that embarrassing, and they wanted to silence that.
Did you pick that up on the website?
Yeah, that's what it said on the website.
Oh.
That's what he wrote, actually, I think.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. You've researched this interview very well.
Well, the Department of...
very impressed.
The Department of Energy has a whole site on your dad, Glenn Seaborg, that has many, many pages, and I can only read some of it. And the first page in the site, it's at the DOE.gov, is a long sort of autobiographical letter that he wrote. That's the beginning of the webpage. It's fascinating.
Where he actually speculated on the political reasons.
Yeah. Right, right. He
seemed to... the journal. Yeah, yeah, well, I talked to him about this, and he was most upset about this whole thing.
It's a terrible invasion.
Pardon?
It's a terrible invasion.
Yes, oh, awful. And then to take something that he put all this work into and then have him worry about whether he's going to get it back at all, and then when he gets it back, some of it's deleted and they won't give it back. Now, another run-in he had with Reagan was it wasn't really a run-in, but Reagan had him, it was under Reagan that he headed, my dad, headed the Committee for Excellence in Education, and he wrote a report on excellence in education.
I read about this too, yeah.
Yeah, now Reagan really didn't...
they basically ignored his work.
Yeah, he didn't really get upset with my dad because he didn't really understand the report, but he did ignore it. Reagan was not interested in education or improving the quality of education because it would take money out of his other programs. He was mainly interested in building a large defense and in cutting taxes for the rich and the corporations. So he ran us up a very large debt without...
Your dad believed that education was really faulting in America, that people in the United States were not getting a good math and science background, and they were not producing the kind of scientists that they needed for the 21st century.
Yeah, that's what my dad wrote in the report, basically. He said the first sentence of the report was something to the effect that if world power, another power, did this to our educational system, we'd consider it an act of war, something like that.
Right.
He was, basically the report was very critical that the United States was not coming up with, we weren't giving the basic math and science education that we need to give people to prepare them, just as you said.
Of this, I wanted to go into a whole discussion. You're sending my mind spinning about everything that's been coming out with the revelations of alleged espionage at Los Alamos,
that's
and
right.
It turns out going back to the Reagan administration. So while Ronald Reagan was going after your dad and taking his personal diaries and trying to classify information for political reasons, allegedly, there was a number of...
huge leak.
A number of foreign scientists working in Los Alamos who were allegedly stealing secrets because we didn't have American scientists to do the job, which I find very interesting. I don't even believe that's true, but it's just interesting.
It's just a funny, right?
Thought, the way the logic works. We're going to move with so many calls.
Like
we're
going to
move on. Thank you very much.
I just want to say that I hope that maybe he does a screenplay on his father's life. Because I think there's a lot there, a lot about what has happened. Basically, this country has bought the intelligence of students that are in MIT or anywhere else, so no one really has the freedom to do the kind of work like Einstein had or his father had. And also, every time I hear Reagan's name, I get angry.
Sorry to leave you angry.
Because I think he was really a lot of presidents were really stupid, but he really took the cake, And he's given much too much credit. It's really dumbing down America or people who put him on. As a great president, give me a break.
Right. Thanks for calling.
I agree with you. You know, when somebody told me Reagan has Alzheimer's disease, my response was, well, how could you tell?
But, more needs to be said about it because, unfortunately, we don't want the next president to be some dummy who was a supporter of Reagan.
Good luck.
Reagan did tremendous damage in appointing someone like James Watt, who, I mean, just totally anti-environmental when...
The Interior Minister at the beginning of his... Or,
Department of Interior. And tremendous damage because environmental issues are really the main ones because we need to save this planet. I mean... It's interesting because I see in the press and the general public very aware that we do have environmental problems. That the problems are real. The public and the press are aware of this, but you don't get the same kind of treatment as in science, where when I read scientific literature, talk to scientists as the evolutionary biologist I am, or go to scientific conferences where I get a different take on it, which is among scientists, it's not only a problem, environmental problems are not only a problem, but so serious that it will lead to the destruction of the entire human race. That is, that there won't be another living human in something like 50 years, or I can't say how long, that's just a guess, unless we do something, because destruction of the ozone, species extinction, and changing of the climate and the ability to produce food and overpopulation are just completely out of control. And Reagan just sped up that whole process of destruction of the planet, as well as taking all of the money out of social programs and putting it into the military.
All right, let's go to another call.
Yeah, we got a lot of callers.
Yeah.
Okay, you're on the radio.
Hello?
David, like, I think you were very far-sighted when you said that you didn't believe in nuclear power, because I was watching Frontline on Channel 13 and also Nova a couple of weeks ago, and they had the story of Three Mile Island there.
Oh, yeah, they're selling it now.
Huh? Jimmy Carter was invited, and Governor Scranton and Rosalynn Carter, and also Governor Thornburg, and they went into the nuclear reactor with other people there, and then 3 or 4 years later, they sent the television down into the core of the nuclear reactor, and it melted down, so they were all exposed too, and Jimmy Carter was a nuclear engineer. And then they had an explosion over in Chernobyl, another explosion of one of the nuclear reactors on Nova. So, I mean, you were very far-sighted when you said you didn't believe in nuclear power.
Well, thank you. I think the main concern right now with nuclear power... See, right now, nuclear power is not economical, so there haven't been nuclear reactors built in the United States for quite a while.
But how safe are the ones that exist? Obviously, they're not safe.
Well, I think the main problem now, and I hope that it's going to turn out okay, but I'm worried.
Well, Three Mile Island didn't turn out okay.
Pardon?
Three Mile Island didn't turn out okay, neither did Chernobyl.
I'm saying I hope it will, but I am worried about Y2K. What is going to happen when year 2000 rolls around? And I think the U.S. is pretty much compliant, but France and Russia and Japan seem to be quite behind on making things compliant for the Y2K bug in their nuclear reactors.